Therapy Notes is the highest rated EHR, practice management, and billing software for mental health professionals. Its all-in-one platform is designed to streamline all aspects of your practice, from connecting with clients via secure messages to scheduling, notes, billing, and more. You can trust Therapy Notes has you covered. And one of the best parts? 24/7 customer service with a live person. It's beyond easy to get help over the phone or by email at any time of day from their knowledgeable and friendly representatives. The best time to give Therapy Notes a try is now. Sign up for your free trial by going to therapynotes.com, clicking Start My Free Trial, and accessing your first 2 months free with the promo code CHAT. See why Therapy Notes is the most trusted EHR for behavioral health professionals today.
Therapists, ready to stop just listening and start doing? I offer several ways to work with me and accelerate your trauma expertise. You can join my Trauma Therapist Network membership community for ongoing support, book a one-on-one clinical consultation with me for personalized guidance, or buy my course for clinicians on supporting survivors of sexual trauma, and check out the retreats coming up in 2026. All that info and more is on the For Therapists page of Trauma Therapist Network, and you can find a link in the show notes.
Therapy Chat Podcast, episode 537.
This is the Therapy Chat Podcast with Laura Reagan, LCSWC. The information shared in this podcast is not a substitute for seeking help from a licensed mental health professional. And now, here's your host, Laura Reagan, LCSWC.
Hi, welcome back to Therapy Chat. I'm your host, Laura Reagan, and this week I have a deeply thought-provoking conversation for you. My guest is Sally Mislansky. Sally Mislansky is a licensed psychotherapist, a speaker, consultant, and the author of A Brilliant Adaptation, How Dissociative Identity and the Power of the Therapeutic Bond Saved Me. Her work centers on the power of relationship, the complexity of the mind, and the possibility of healing even in the aftermath of profound childhood trauma. Drawing on her lived experience and years of clinical practice as an interpersonal neurobiology-informed educator, Sally also writes the Substack Making Sense with Sally, where she reflects on resilience, meaning-making, and the everyday practices that support a coherent and compassionate life. So we met at Psychotherapy Networker this year, 2026, and Sally let me know that she had written a book about living with DID and how her therapist, Dr. Dan Siegel, helped her heal. The reason why I think this is a really thought-provoking conversation is, for one thing, it illuminates how we can think we're fine and never really even consider that we might not be fine. And there can be a whole different experience hidden behind our defensive strategies that are brilliantly adapted to help us, well, to protect us from feeling what was intolerable, unbearable at the time when it occurred. Sally is going to talk about living with DID, what it was like to work with her therapist, Dr. Dan Siegel, how she discovered that she had disorganized attachment that had led her to develop dissociative identity disorder, how Dr. Siegel's care and the therapeutic relationship, his hope and belief in healing, helped her believe that it was possible for things to be different. And she talks about what the process of healing looked like. And I say healing and DID, and I know that many people who are listening will be wondering, is it possible to heal from DID? Is DID something that can heal and change and someone can have it and then not have it anymore? We've talked about this in other conversations when I interviewed Dr. Jamie Marich about her book, Dissociation Made Simple, and I will link to that in the show notes, as well as when Jamie and I were together with Dr. Dick Schwartz talking about parts work and concepts about plurality and integration. But Sally explains why she considers herself to have healed from DID. And it makes sense to me too. But it's all a matter of how you think about it, how the language that you use, what you think it all means, and if you believe in dissociation, dissociative identity disorder, and whether or not you think that a condition like DID can heal. It's pretty fascinating and definitely questions some of the ways that we have been trained to think about dissociation, trauma, memory, healing. There's so much here, and I think that if you're a therapist, listening to this will help you become a better therapist as you consider things that you might not have thought about before. I'm curious to hear your thoughts when you listen. I have deep respect for Sally for sharing her story and deep appreciation for everybody who with lived experience for sharing their perspectives. Let's get into it. Hi, welcome back to Therapy Chat. I'm your host, Laura Reagan, and today I'm very happy to be here with Sally Maslansky. Sally, thank you so much for being my guest on Therapy Chat today.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm very happy to be here. Looking forward to our talk.
Me too. I'm so happy. We ran into each other at Psychotherapy Networker this year, and you were telling me about your book, A Brilliant Adaptation, and your story is very interesting. And I know this will be so important and informative for listeners, whether you are a mental health professional and other type of helping professional who works with people, or just someone who's curious about your own mental health. This is a really fascinating topic. So before we get into what we're going to be talking about, I just want to invite you to tell our listeners a little bit more about who you are and what you do.
Thanks. Okay. So yes, my name is Sally Maslansky, and I am a licensed marriage and family therapist. I have a private practice. I live and work in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And in January, my first and only book was published. It's called A Brilliant Adaptation, How Dissociative Identity Disorder and the Power of the Therapeutic Bond Saved Me. And it's a memoir, and it is about the work I did over a period of 10 years, and then my life afterwards, with Dr. Dan Siegel, who diagnosed me with what at the time was still called multiple personality disorder. A few years after we started, it was changed to dissociative identity disorder, and how that process of therapy, that therapeutic process, I resolved the extreme trauma of my childhood and no longer live a dissociated life. Yeah. And so it's the story of that.
Beautiful and powerful. You know, when you and I first encountered each other at the conference, there was so much in what you said your book was about your own lived experience with DID, being a therapist, and that your therapist was Dan Siegel, which is just like, oh, that's the pinnacle of therapy in my mind.
It's the thing that most people are interested in about me.
Right.
What was it like to have him as my therapist? Which is exactly what my book tells the whole story of, what it was like to be his patient. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, Dan Siegel is more than a celebrity therapist, and you are more than a client of a celebrity therapist. The story of being diagnosed with DID, first of all, it's a hard enough diagnosis to receive despite so many people walking around with the symptoms and not being identified with that disorder or adaptation, as your book calls it.
It's what Dan called it.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. So let me just, I want to name that so many therapists have limited understanding of trauma at all. So many therapists have limited understanding of attachment at all. So many therapists have no awareness of dissociation or dissociative identity disorder. A lot of therapists don't believe that it's a real thing. And I think it's really important for all of us to know about this, to know that it exists and there are people walking around, even therapists who have DID, and people can live thriving lives with DID. And your book is about how your symptoms resolved to where you don't have DID now. So there's so much here that I think is very mind opening.
Yes.
So can we start off though by talking about what was going on with you that led you to have that diagnosis? How'd that happen?
You mean, how did I end up meeting with Dan, or how did I develop? Okay. So
I want to know, like, what was going on that led to you getting that diagnosis? Because I think that piece is something that people have a lot of ideas based on popular culture about what DID is like. And a lot of it's misunderstood.
Yeah, very much in the popular culture and the film and television business portrayal of it. So in 1990, I was 36 years old, very happily married, living a wonderful life. And my husband and I went to Romania to adopt our son. And this was just the most happy, joyful journey for us. But the minute I got to Romania, I mean, literally almost the minute we landed, I started to become filled with these intense feelings of terror, just terrified. And, you know, there was a part of me that sort of thought, well, you know, this country just was 6 months since they had this bloody revolution. It was kind of a sketchy place to be. I mean, the Romanian people are incredible, but it was not an easy place to be. But, you know, it took about 3 months and two trips to Romania before we were able to bring our son, Sam, home. And we brought him home when he was 16 months old. And of course, I had read every book there was to read about becoming a mother and having a young child or having a baby. But I had not read any books that addressed, you know, adopting a child who'd spent the first 16 months of their life in an orphanage in Romania. So I did some research, and somebody told me I needed to go to UCLA, that there was an infant toddler clinic there that would, you know, be the place to have him evaluated. So I made an appointment there, and the director of that clinic was Dan Siegel. And on this first meeting with him, with Sam, there was something about him that just resonated with me so deeply, because there were so many people in our life that thought we were crazy to go to Romania and bring this child home. And Dan Siegel's take on it was that he was doing great, right? And from an attachment point of view, yeah, he did the strange situation with both his dad and I. He scored secure on both. And Dan was very clear, and I didn't know anything about attachment. I was not a therapist then, that there had to have been someone in that orphanage that somehow was connected to Sam. Because he said, you guys are doing a great job and keep doing it. But there is no question that Sam had somebody who knew him in that orphanage. And of course, knowing about attachment now, that makes so much sense. So everything's good. Sam's fine. But within the next year, these feelings of terror just intensified for me. So I thought, you know, I'm going to go see that Dr. Siegel, and I'm going to ask him to help me, because I need to figure out what these feelings are about. Because my fear was that there was something terribly wrong with Sam, that there was some hidden Romanian danger that just hadn't, you know, been known yet. So I went to see him and we talked. And even though Dan wasn't working directly with Sam, Sam was being monitored by the UCLA clinic because they were so interested in this, you know, little Romanian baby. You know, I think he was the first one from those circumstances they had worked with. So it was an incredible situation. So they were monitoring, and he was doing really well.
Can I interrupt for a second? I'm sorry for interrupting, but just for people who are listening who might not know about this, but I remember from living in that time that this was when, after the Romanian Revolution, there was there were all these news stories that we were seeing here in the U.S. about how the orphanages were so understaffed that many of the babies weren't being held at all. There weren't enough
None
people.
Of them were. I mean, these babies, yeah. These are babies that had been warehoused through the dictatorship of Nicolae Ceaușescu. And they were just, and then after the revolution, it just opened up and there were just warehouses full of babies lined up in cribs. Yeah.
Yes. I remember seeing images of that on the news, and then for those of us who've learned about child brain development and trauma, much of what has been learned or the early learnings in the 90s and 2000s about that came from studying the effects of that neglect on these babies with imaging scans. And so this I can understand why they were so interested in the clinic. And
yes,
oh, here's and a really well-adjusted baby from this,
they learned a
this
lot.
Environment. Yeah.
So thank you for clarifying that, because a lot of people, especially younger people, don't have no memory of all that. So anyway, so I went to Dr. Siegel. When I saw him as a patient, I called him Dr. Siegel. We're colleagues and friends, and I call him Dan. But if I go back and forth, that's why.
Yeah.
So I went to see Dr. Siegel, and I started telling him the story, and I started crying because there were these two books that had been gifts to Sam as a child from friends, and one was called The Family That Grew, and the other one was called On the Day You Were Born. And they were both these beautiful books. One was about adoption, and just how we brought you home, and your all the family came to see you. You're so loved. We've got a beautiful family. We love family, family, family. And then On the Day You Were Born, it's everything that's happening in the universe on the day you're born to prepare the earth for your arrival. Now I just got chills even thinking about them. I could not read these books without just tears just streaming, like floods of tears. And so I brought the books with me. I showed him, tears. And he was curious. He said, well, I mean, his stance at first was, I know Sam's doing really well, because I haven't seen him, but I'm keeping track with him through the clinic. And so I'm wondering, is there something that's happened, since I saw you last year with Sam? And I said, no. I said, I'm just really worried. And after a little while, he said, I think maybe I need to understand a little bit more about your own childhood, Sally, because I think this might have more to do with that than what's going on with Sam. And I said, okay. And he said, well, tell me about your childhood. And I said, well, what do you want to know? And he said, well, what kind of childhood did you have? And I said, I had a good childhood. And he said, oh, good. And he said, well, can you tell me about it? And I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, you told me you had a good childhood. Can you tell me something good about it? And I said, well, I don't remember my childhood. And he said, well, how do you know it was good then? And this was just like a mind-blowing moment for me, because I thought, oh my gosh, I'm 37 and it's clear I have no memory of my childhood, but this is the first moment in the 37 years that I thought it's significant. A, that I don't remember it, and B, that it's just occurring to me now. And this is how it started to unroll, right? And I just started seeing him on a very regular basis. And within a few months, he diagnosed me with what was then called multiple personality disorder. And one of the things I said to him when I first started seeing him was, I was afraid I was losing my mind. I was afraid I was crazy. And he very much assured me I was not crazy. So when he told me what he believed I had was multiple personality disorder, of course, all I knew about multiple personality disorder was the movie Sybil, which didn't resonate with me at all. I said, well, then I am crazy. And he said, no, Sally, you're not crazy. He said, I'd say you're just the opposite of crazy. So I think that multiple personality disorder was a brilliant adaptation for a child in your position to adapt. A brilliant adaptation, which is, of course, the name of my book. And it's really important to stress, because I think one of the reasons my therapy was so successful with Dr. Siegel was that he didn't just believe I was going to get better. His knowledge of the way the mind works and the brain works is neuroscience, even in 1991, was that he knew that this was resolvable. because he knew this wasn't something broken or pathological. He knew it extended from something that we know now as disorganized attachment, which was his specialty, attachment. And he knew that it would take time and it would be hard and painful, but he had no doubt that I would be able to resolve the many traumas of my childhood and resolve it and no longer live a dissociated life if that's what I chose, right? And it was just so, knowing what I know now as a therapist myself and what I know about attachment, it was so crucial, I believe, that not just that he understood what DID was or MPD was, but that his belief that the mind had a way of healing itself. And so it never once occurred to me that I would be like this forever, that I would struggle with the things I was struggling with forever. It was essential to the outcome I had, I believe.
Thank you for sharing some of that background. And it's a beautiful story, the part that I've heard.
Well, people do. There are very hard parts of my story because it is an unfolding from our first meeting until many years later. And it really is an unfolding of my memories coming to me and us resolving it. And it involved several hospitalizations and very difficult work. But it was always held in positivity and belief and knowledge, always. And I actually asked him recently, I think I asked him this on the stage at the Networker, because it occurred to me that I say he never believed, he didn't, he always knew that I would heal, but I wasn't sure that was true because I never asked him. So I said, did you actually believe that? And you just, or was there a part of it that was like, God, I don't know if she's going to make it. And he said, no, I knew you were going to resolve this. I knew it was going to be resolved. Yes.
Yeah, you said his belief, and I feel like it's like hope is the word that you're naming. It's like he really had a deep belief in the hope that this is really possible, not just, I guess once I said hope out loud, then I feel like it makes it seem like it's like an idea, but it's,
you know, he very much kept hope alive for me because there were moments where I was like,
it's something tangible in this process.
It was very tangible. He always kept it alive for me when I couldn't even believe in it.
Yeah. So there's a couple of points that you made that I want to emphasize in terms of just the idea of everyone listening, thinking about recognizing DID and dissociation. You mentioned that when you went to see him, you were very happily married and your childhood, when he asked you about it, you said it was a good childhood, you know. So, I mean, for one thing, just the way that he asked you, well, how do you know it was good, is something that I think oftentimes when we notice that incongruence in our assessment, we don't always explore it more. Sometimes we just make up other ideas about what that is.
Well, those questions are from the adult attachment interview, which I use, even though I don't really treat anybody with DID and never have, that's the beginning for me for everybody, all my clients. And in interpersonal neurobiology, which is the form of therapy, the field of therapy, the field that Dan developed that informs therapy, it's not a form of therapy, it's very essential. And of course, the heart of interpersonal neurobiology, which Dan hadn't written a book yet when we started working together, but he was certainly, this was his field and it's how he worked. The process of making sense, right? And the making sense process from an interpersonal neurobiology point of view, I'm going to read you what the definition of it is. It's at the front of my book. It gives a couple of definitions So making sense process is a process of sorting through memory, here and now experience, and imagination such that we create a coherent picture of the essence of what is occurring in her life. So the AAI is developed to show us where there is incoherence in our narrative. So, I had a good childhood, but I don't remember my childhood. he knew that's, we need to explore that. He didn't know right then I had MPD, but that was, you know, we, let's look at that. Isn't that interesting? Not, oh my God, you don't remember. I mean, it was nothing catastrophic. It was just, he was curious about it. Got me curious about it. And that's where we started. We started trying to figure out what was going on in my childhood that made it so I don't remember it. And he was also very clear, you know, just because you don't remember your childhood doesn't mean there was abuse or neglect. You, there's a big portion of the I don't know if it's the universal or the American population that don't remember their childhood. It's normal childhood amnesia. And it's usually often associated with an avoidant, non-organized but non-secure avoidant measurement of attachment in childhood, which doesn't mean you were abused or neglected. It's just a very specific kind of attention that you get from the, your caregivers. Yeah. So it was really clear about that. There was never, oh, she's got DID from that. Yeah.
Right. It wasn't just, oh, she doesn't remember her childhood. She has DID.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. So, but it's also like, pay attention. Someone doesn't remember their childhood. Let's be curious about that with the person. And I just want to say out loud where I think a lot of us therapists go wrong in assessment, and it's because of our lack of knowledge and understanding and training, is to hear something incongruent and say, oh, this person's not being truthful. And then we want to go, well, which is it? You did have a good childhood or you didn't have? And the person's like, I don't know, you know, like, and they
suddenly
start
they
to
feel like they're a liar.
Right? Yeah. Yes. Or they're, I need to answer this a certain way. They're looking for a certain response and I'm not sure what to say. Well, that's not helpful at all in a therapeutic process or an assessment. And some of the things that can happen in the therapeutic process that we might see as pathology could be really where we mucked it up while we were trying to, you know, help the person understand what's going on.
Yeah. And that's why I'm such a advocate of the field of interpersonal neurobiology, because it is such a big field and it includes, you know, mindful awareness, somatic work. I mean, it's that it's just a huge field and it informs us and it guides me as a therapist. And I'm always looking, you know, for those places where the story doesn't make sense, even if it's not about abuse. But if somebody tells me that they just grounded their teenage daughter for a month and she's like having all kinds of meltdowns because of it. And I'll say, well, why was she grounded? Well, because she rolled her eyes when I asked her to, you know, cook, set the table. Now, there's something that doesn't really quite make sense, you know? So let's help you now understand what that all meant to you. So you can, you know, thought, okay, for her to do that, it's probably not, doesn't mean what you thought it meant. And it's probably not worth being grounded for. But for some reason, that meant that signaled some sort of danger or disrespect to you, which probably wasn't what was going on. So it's always about trying to make sense. There's a, and, you know, I just want to put this in there because it's the first thing Dan told me, like in our second or third session. I think it was our first, but I'm pretty sure it was our second. He explained to me about implicit memory. And this, again, this was the first time I began to understand that there was something going on with me that we would figure out. And what how he explained it was, he said, you know, the way the brain encodes memory is two ways, implicitly and explicitly. And for the earliest part of childhood, memory is pretty much completely stored implicitly because the hippocampus is not yet fully formed. Right? So that's where that childhood amnesia can come through. But here's the difference. When I retrieve an explicit memory, I know I'm remembering something from my past. I can know that when I was 10, I went to Disneyland and I had a great time, but something bad happened and I got upset or I got sick to my stomach, but I'm not like, oh God, I could never go to Disneyland again because something horrible happened. I just know it was, you know, something unpleasant. But an implicit memory, when I retrieve it, does not come with the tag that it's coming from my past. So the feelings of it, the terror that I was feeling when I landed in Romania and walked into Dr. Siegel's office and was reading those books, was 100% in my conscious awareness. But what was not in conscious awareness was that it was my history, not my present. And once you really start to understand that, it's mind-blowing and it starts to truly help you make sense. And I explained this once to a girlfriend of mine, one of my best friends, who's a lifelong Al-Anon person. And she said, that sounds like something we say in Al-Anon. And I said, what's that? She said, we say that if I'm hysterical, it's historical. And it's such a good, it's like a little mantra for me. If I have a response to anything that I'm sort of like, this doesn't feel quite right. Why am I responding like this? Like, why when a good friend just told me they won the lottery and they won $1 billion, I'm like, oh, that's nice. You know what I mean? It's like, I should be really happy. I need to do some work. This is my work, not theirs. And it's just a really good guideline for as therapists, not just for therapists to look for it in our own clients, but to our own responses, like what you were saying earlier.
Yeah.
Well, is it a lie or not? What's that about? I mean,
why are we worried about if someone's lying? Why are we trying to catch people in a lie?
Or why, if someone's telling us something they're not sure of or isn't even true, why do we go straight to that it's a lie?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Maybe they're just, let's be curious about what's going on. And that's why it's so important to understand our own stuff as therapists. And I think, as you were saying, the training that therapists, I decided to become a therapist inspired by the work I did with Dan after 10 years, and I was very resolved. And I kept waiting for them to teach me what I learned about the mind and the brain and mindful awareness.
I'm sure you weren't learning a lot of IPNB stuff at that time.
There was nothing. And then when I did my training, to get my hours, again, nothing, and very much prohibitive about some of the things that I could talk about. And I don't see, I now live in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. It's a very, this area, there's lots of academic institutions, some really stellar ones. And I still don't see them teaching much about neuroscience in therapeutic circles.
Yeah. I know there are neuroscience programs in some universities, but they're not really clinical. They're more leading towards something medical or research.
And it's where change happens. I mean, especially now that we know about neuroplasticity and the ability to change our brains throughout our lifespan, and the fact that our brains are changing throughout our lifespan, whether we're paying attention or not. And if we want to change it to work for us, we can choose that and work on that. Yeah, it's so important.
Anyway. Yes, it is. And I'll real quick say a little plug about this too, that Dan Siegel has been a prolific author and he's contributed a number of books on the topic of interpersonal neurobiology, but he's also curated and edited the Norton series on interpersonal neurobiology, which is like a
hundreds
library.
Of titles. Steve Porges has written, Deb Dana.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a huge
Alan
library.
Sure. There's so many.
Luke
Great
Casalino,
thinkers
lots
in
of, yes,
yes, and these books are, I mean, to be honest, one reason why Therapy Chat podcast is what it is because we've had so many of the authors of these books on the show, and I've learned so much personally as a therapist from sitting with people and just absorbing this knowledge and asking questions about it, but I didn't learn any of that in grad school.
Zero.
And I graduated in 2010. So, that's still.
That long ago. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't think a lot's changed. I really don't. Yeah.
I don't either, sadly. And I see it because of, having interns in our practice. We see that it's tightening more towards the cognitive and the not cognitive science per se, but like CBT and DBT and those skills based
Very manualized. And this
manualized,
and there's a place for all of
those methods.
And interpersonal neurobiology, encompasses everything.
Yeah.
But like it, what
it's
I
more integrative
so
though. It's more integrative.
That's right. And interpersonal neurobiology it informs you as a therapist where to look for what's the best way to think about this, and then bring in all your big guns to work on it. Yes. Yeah.
Therapy Notes is consistently transforming the way therapists manage their practices with continuous updates designed to save money and improve efficiency. Their latest game changer, Therapy Fuel, a powerful and fully integrated suite of AI tools that streamline documentation so you can focus more on your clients. With AI features that help by generating progress notes from summaries or transcriptions, creating contact notes directly from clients' secure messages, and automated summaries of client history forms, Therapy Notes users are already reporting hours of saved time and energy. Some other recent feature improvements include automated recurring client payments, electronic secondary insurance billing, and their constantly expanding library of outcome measures. The best time to give Therapy Notes a try is now. Sign up for your free trial by going to therapynotes.com, clicking Start My Free Trial, and accessing your first 2 months free with the promo code CHAT. See why Therapy Notes is the most trusted EHR for behavioral health professionals today.
Therapists ready to stop just listening and start doing? I offer several ways to work with me and accelerate your trauma expertise. You can join my Trauma Therapist Network membership community for ongoing support, book a one-on-one clinical consultation with me for personalized guidance, or buy my course for clinicians on supporting survivors of sexual trauma, and check out the retreats coming up in 2026. All that info and more is on the For Therapists page of Trauma Therapist Network, and you can find a link in the show notes.
This is so, so helpful. And the next thing I want to ask you about that you mentioned in the last chunk of talking was about disorganized attachment. It's, again, people hear about attachment and they hear about a secure and insecure attachment, but most people don't get a lot of information. And oftentimes you'll hear like there's secure and insecure, and then there's disorganized, but that's a whole nother topic. And then you never hear that topic. So I think that's a really important thing to kind of define and explain for people as well.
And so let's also just mention, without really getting into it, that attachment is so misunderstood and misused in so many ways. And first of all, something that Dan talks a lot about now is that from the Mary Ainsworth, John Bowlby attachment research theory, attachment is not a style. In fact, I think Dan said that Mary Main actually yelled at him once, who was his teacher, you can't call attachment a style. It's not like a pair of shoes, right? It's a measure. It's truly a measure of a moment in time, really, when my son went through the strange situation. It was a measure of what was going on with Sam right then in response to his father's presence and my presence. But so disorganized attachment, the way I understand it is, so, you know, there's secure and non-secure, not insecure, forms of attachment. So there's secure attachment, which is organized secure. Then there's non-secure, but organized avoidant, not organized non-secure ambivalent. And then there's disorganized attachment. And what disorganized attachment means, you know, it's called it's neurobiologists, I think, call it a biological paradox, fear without solution. Because what disorganized attachment means is this: as a baby, my attachment circuitry is hardwired to go towards my caregivers for everything. I can't stay alive. Right? I need them to feed me, to clothe me, to house me, and also to attune to my internal world, to my emotional world. So in disorganized attachment, what happens is I'm upset. I'm a baby and I'm scared or being hurt. So my attachment circuitry says, go towards your attachment figure to be cared for. But at the same time, my brainstem is saying, no, you need to get away from the source of terror. And in this case, the source of terror is my caregiver. And my mind cannot make sense of I need to go away from my caregiver. So the brain can fragment, right? Or the mind can fragment. And that's what creates disorganized attachment. And disorganized attachment can lead to dissociative identity disorder. Yeah. Which is, it's a very protective thing to happen. In fact, there is a bit of a movement within the dissociative identity world to call it, to rename it in the next DSM, disorganized attachment response, or to refer to as an adaptation as opposed to a disorder. Because if you think about it, it's actually the name of my book, which stands it. It's a brilliant adaptation for a little 0 to 7 year old facing this kind of massive biological paradox, fear without solution, to figure out a way to survive in this family, to be able to have to experience serious abuse, often sexual abuse at night, and then have to, you know, get up in the morning, go have breakfast with those people, and then be okay and get dressed and go to school. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
How would that be possible without dissociation?
It wouldn't be. It wouldn't be. So exactly. That's why I think of myself. It sounds weird to some people, I think, but I feel like luckiest person in the world. You might even, I mean, very unlucky to be born into the family I was, but very lucky to have had a mind that was able to dissociate in this manner to keep me safe. Yeah. Until I got to a place in my 30s where I was happily married, had an incredibly supportive husband, and, adopting this little boy, and I believe it's because of the attachment circuitry that whatever was going on for me as I was rescuing this little boy, right? And I had came out in therapy, had this massive fantasy world as a young child of being rescued myself, just exploded and brought it out. And now I met Dr. Siegel and was able to, with the incredible support of the man I was married to, incredibly supportive, I was able to get the help I needed.
Thank you again for explaining that about disorganized attachment. And we'll see what happens with the DSM, because past history, they don't tend to. We'll have a lot of talk about these, you know, progressive updates, and they tend to go another way a lot of times. But I hope that won't be the case. We'll see.
We're going to keep hope alive.
We're going to keep hope alive. As Jesse Jackson always said. So another word you used, and I feel it's kind of like a next piece to go into, is you mentioned that the process of healing for you, the process of resolving the dissociative symptoms, was an unfolding. And you talked about like kind of how you went into this with a lack of memory about a lot of things, and things began to kind of open for you. I want to name again, this is a common experience in trauma therapy for people. And there's a lot of popular misconception, I think, about the idea of, you know, recovered memories and things like that. It's like this idea that when the person comes to therapy, the therapist begins to tell them what happened to them, which I know that's not what we do or how it is, but can you talk about what that was like for you?
Sure. And, you know, so when I started seeing Dan in 1991, was simultaneously what was happening was the False Memory Foundation or whatever was being formed. And Dan was very aware.
The Satanic Panic.
Yeah. Yes. And Dan was very aware of it. And we talked about it. And he was very, I mean, he was so careful, right? And never suggested anything. But it was, and I think if I'd been with any other therapist or many other therapists, it would have frightened them too much to maybe even work with me, which I think sometimes happens. But Dan was very solid in his understanding of what was going on. So I was in very good hands. But the unfolding part is so really, I mean, I hated hearing it. And whenever I'd read an article about false memory, and of course, eventually that's what my family would think was going on, was that it was all these false memories that I was being implanted in by. But it just wasn't at all what was happening. But Dan's belief in just holding it solid, I'm safe in his office, we're going to figure this out, keep hope alive, it was the true heartbeat of my therapy with him. But the unfolding was like this. So once I realized that I had no memory of my childhood, and I wanted to figure out why. And I also, and it was interesting because my husband at the time remembered like when he was 2. You know what I mean? He had such a huge memory of his childhood. And it was just such an interesting combination. So I was really, really committed to understand before I even knew about DID to figuring it out. And what would happen in therapy is I would go in and we would talk. And after a little while, I write about this in the book. There's one session in particular that I showed up for therapy and I was like an hour late. And we were doing very lengthy sessions. I remember Darcio asking me what time I thought our appointment had been. And I said, now. And he said, no, we made it. We changed it. We talked yesterday and we changed it. So you've missed an hour. And I had no awareness of that conversation. I had no idea. And then after that, it started becoming more and more clear to me that I would sometimes be in session with Dan and I wouldn't remember being in session, right? So Dan was starting to meet different states of mind that I wasn't aware of, right? And as we talked about this, and he never, ever, ever told me what one state was doing. His belief was that, you know, all the different states were his clients. And there, even though I don't think there was HIPAA back then, there was confidentiality. The therapy was going to be me discovering it, right? So I began to become a little bit more aware of different states. I was journaling, I kept a diary, and there would be interactions between the different states of mind. And that's something that's so important to understand about what really to me is the hallmark of DID is that there are different states of mind. And in interpersonal neurobiology, we think of the states of minds as verbs, not nouns, right? They are actions. They are memories. They are feelings. They are not individualized people, right? Living separate lives that are protected by protective memory barriers. And once in my therapy, I started becoming more aware of the different states. That's when that was the unfolding. Because once I understood that there was a state of mind that was protective in this way, or a state of mind that was able to bear something here, once I was able to know about that state of mind and another state of mind, that meant the memory barriers were dissolving. And once all the memory barriers dissolved, I no longer have DID, right? Because now I just remember everything that happened. I don't remember them separately. And that took a long time. It took many years. I worked with Dan for 10 years as a patient. Within the first 7 years, the DID was pretty much resolved. And then the next 3 years was sort of just, you know, making sense of my life post-DID. Yeah.
And in those 10 years, were you doing multi-hour sessions per week even?
I was seeing him all the time. And I have to just say, I was extremely, again, lucky me, fortunate that I had a husband that was 100% supportive, wanted me to do whatever I needed to do to figure this all out. You know, it was a different world in terms of insurance and things like that. And I was able to afford it. It was a real, life-saving for me. So I was seeing him at least 3 times a week, often for 2+ hours a session. And, you know, so we got a lot of work done.
Because I will say the reason I ask that is because 10 years is kind of relatively short for what people's process looks like a lot of times. And it makes sense that because you were working so intensively is why your healing process or, you know, your process of recovery resolution, I use the word healing. That's my word. Like I talk about the healing process or healing journey, but some people say healing's not possible or not real. Yeah.
It's 100%. I'm living proof. I'm fully healed from DID. I'll give you a great example. When I came to DC for the networker, right? The first 7 years of my life, right? Which is within that period of time that I developed disorganized attachment, was in Silver Spring, Maryland. Right. So for the networker, I drove not so far from there. And a friend of mine went with me, and she was going to spend the week in D.C. with a friend of hers, and then we would drive back together at the end of the conference. And her friend lived in Silver Spring. And her friend lived within a couple blocks of the house I grew up in. So I wanted to go by that house. So my girlfriend that drove with me was very nervous about me going to this house, you know, where all the bad things happened.
Yeah.
And it just wasn't a concern for me. I was excited to see I could look at that house and I could know everything that happened in it without feeling any of it. None of the terror, none of the fear came up. It was just, I wanted to, and I couldn't do the walking because if you recall, it was pouring with rain in D.C. that week. So I just drove, you know, the best I could, the route. And it was just joyful for me to remember me as a little five-year-old walking to school, happy to be getting to school, you know, full on DID, having no idea. But this part of me was able to go to school and be happy and have friends. Yeah. So there was none of that, I'm going to fall apart. I'm going to remember everything. Nothing. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean that I don't live a dissociated life. I don't have parts anymore. That's, let's just say it. Yeah. And my parts were always verbs. They were never nouns. And I know a lot of therapies kind of think of them as nouns. And this just wasn't my experience.
And I mean, one thing that's really important, I think, and for therapists, mental health professionals, family members of people who have DID, people who suspect you might have DID, each person's experience is their own. And there is space for everyone's experience to be valid.
100%. Yeah. Yes. And as a therapist, we have to follow our clients where they are, whether it's DID or, you know, whatever we're dealing with, they are the lead. I somebody reached out to me recently to say that they were so happy having read my book because there was something about my book that resonated with their experience, and they felt that their therapist was insisting that they feel something or remember something that they didn't feel or remember. And, you know, and I said as gently as I could, you know, I think it's good that you're following your own belief and truth. And because there's no rote here, there's no checklist for DID. There really isn't. Yeah. There's no, okay, now we can go on to the next step. It's very global. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the ways that you know, my perspective on the process is about if this is what someone wants, is it wouldn't be my agenda, but what the process would look like would be that dissolving those amnestic barriers, I believe
they're
called.
The amnesia. Yeah. I mean, yeah. That's what makes DID problematic. It's what allowed me to stay sane and grow up and not and you know, be able to have a good life. But at a certain point, it was very much, you know, obviously I've just adopted this little boy and I'm terrified something's wrong with him, you know?
Yeah.
And that wasn't helping me. And once the memory barriers dissolved, I could know, it was like my husband. I could know everything about my childhood, good and bad, and not be disturbed by any of it anymore. I could know it was disturbing, but I didn't feel disturbed by anything anymore. And I spent many years in therapy terrified of any state of mind that was coming forward. And it was Dan's belief and knowledge that nothing bad really was going to happen in our therapy sessions, you know? And then once I started to realize that, I mean, we had precautions, you know, he would say, well, if this state of mind comes forward there, you know, there's no harming people. There's no harming furniture. You can beat up a pillow. I had newspapers I could rip up. I had lots of things, but you know, no personal damage. And once a state of mind, and this was my experience, I don't know if this is anybody else's, but my experience was once I was felt safe enough to allow the state of mind to come and talk to Dan and meet Dan and me be present, these states of mind that I was terrified of were going to be like fireballs and rageful and murderous and horrible. They were kids. They were the state of mind of a little kid who was terrified or angry and wanted to kill somebody because they were four. So it's like being afraid of a four-year-old who wants to hurt you. And once that came out, it was just it. I mean, it took a long time for me to just be like, okay, I'm good with whatever comes up. I mean, it took a couple of years before I was able to be fully, I know this is scary, but it's not going to be bad. I'm just going to be information. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it was honestly just the most phenomenal thing that's ever happened to me in my life. It was an incredible opportunity to understand truly how my mind worked. Yeah.
This is such a rich conversation, and I'm so grateful that you have written about your experience and that you are here talking about it for our listeners and with me. I think the last thing I want to say, I mean, there's so much more we could discuss, but if we had time, the last thing I want to say is about like thinking about DID and what I said before about those like skills-based therapies, which have their place, and I'm not dismissing them in general, but if we were looking at this work using that approach only, it's like an excavating, you know, let's find this memory, clear that one, you know, and there's other ways that oftentimes, you know, there's this like, let's go in, we'll get this memory, clear it, the target, clear it, versus like really kind of understanding the meaning-making process is such an important aspect, because this is, it's like the development of self, who we are, and without the adaptations that we had to have to survive not having our needs met or being harmed during childhood, that is such a beautiful process in itself. And I want everyone who's listening who thinks about therapy to understand that can be and is such an important part of what therapy is.
Oh, it's the essence of it. Yeah, it's that making sense process. No matter what you're making sense of, it's to be able to. So when I was at that house in Silver Spring, right, that to me was the ultimate of integration and making sense. Because here I was, 72 years old, looking at the house where, you know, the scene of the crime, let's say.
Yeah.
Right. And I could know everything that happened. Without being upset, it could inform my life today and how happy I am and what's going on in my life. And I was getting ready to go, my future, and present at the Psychotherapy Networker with Dan Siegel, my therapist, my mentor, you know, my lifesaver in so many ways. I mean, it was just an encapsulation of what life can be and an understanding it all and it all being good, it all being good.
Well, I am so happy for you about what has unfolded in your life and how you're out there sharing about this for others' benefit. In fact, you mentioned that you presented at the Networker, but you also told me before we started recording that you're going to be presenting at the Oxford Transform Trauma Conference as well.
Yes, yes. I'm presenting again with Dan. And it's in September. I think it's 4 days in September. And we are presenting on a Thursday, which is the 17th. And okay. It's going to be, it's a conversation. It's not a lecture. It's Dan and I talking about the unfolding of our therapeutic process together. Yeah.
That sounds fabulous. And so where can people find your book, your work, the talks, everything that's going on?
So it's where everything is centrally located is my website, which is just sallymaslansky.com. There's links to all the podcasts I've done, everything I've written. There's a link to the trauma conference, and I have discount codes if anybody's interested in that.
Great.
So you get it all there. But my book is, and there's links to buy the book. You can buy it on Amazon. Local bookstores carry it. Barnes & Noble, New Harbinger, my publishers, they have a website. So, you know, it's readily available. But there's links to all of that on my website and to all my social media also.
Beautiful. Well, Sally, it's been wonderful to speak with you today about your work and your life and your book. And I'm really grateful to you for being my guest on Therapy Chat.
And I so appreciate you inviting me. This has been a wonderful conversation. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you. Thank you for hosting me.
Oh, thank you. Therapy Notes is the highest rated EHR, practice management, and billing software for mental health professionals. Its all-in-one platform is designed to streamline all aspects of your practice, from connecting with clients via secure messages to scheduling, notes, billing, and more. You can trust Therapy Notes has you covered. And one of the best parts? 24/7 customer service with a live person. It's beyond easy to get help over the phone or by email at any time of day from their knowledgeable and friendly representatives. The best time to give Therapy Notes a try is now. Sign up for your free trial by going to therapynotes.com, clicking Start My Free Trial, and accessing your first 2 months free with the promo code CHAT. See why Therapy Notes is the most trusted EHR for behavioral health professionals today.
Therapists ready to stop just listening and start doing? I offer several ways to work with me and accelerate your trauma expertise. You can join my Trauma Therapist Network membership community for ongoing support, book a one-on-one clinical consultation with me for personalized guidance, or buy my course for clinicians on supporting survivors of sexual trauma, and check out the retreats coming up in 2026. All that info and more is on the For Therapists page of Trauma Therapist Network, and you can find a link in the show notes.
Thank you for listening to Therapy Chat with your host, Laura Reagan, LCSWC. For more information, please visit therapychatpodcast.com.